Okay, guys, today in this podcast, we are going to be covering ancient Mesopotamia and Persia. So if you would like to pull up your PowerPoint on D2L, then you can follow along with what I'm going to be talking about today. Keep in mind that we're going to cover quite a few different civilizations and areas today. So if you get confused, just make sure you're following along. I've got maps along the way to help direct you so you can kind of get a visual of where we're talking about in relation to today. So our first area is ancient Mesopotamia, which is where we finished talking about the Neolithic era. Remember, the Neolithic era was when we moved into farming and agriculture. We were domesticating animals and we needed land for this that was fertile. And so we talked about Mesopotamia because it is the Fertile Crescent, the land between the two rivers, the Tigris River and the Euphrates. So this is where we're picking up today. This is the area that if there was a Garden of Eden, that biblical narrative of the Garden of Eden, this is where people, scholars presume it would have been located. This is an extremely important area because three religions come from this area, this region. Judaism, Islam, and Christianity all trace their birth of their religion to this area. So most of our discoveries come about in the 1800s, in the 19th century, and they include carvings. Relief carvings mean that it's not a sculpture. It's not something I can walk all the way around. A relief carving would be like a plaque that you carve into or a wall. It's three-dimensional, you can touch it and feel it, but you can't walk around it. So we have relief carvings of war and hunting, lots of gold, jewelry, artworks that are unique to this culture that show their gods. We find these and even some musical instruments. And these are mostly found in the Royal Cemetery in the 1920s. And this is in Iraq. This discovery in the 1920s, the valuables, the information, just everything discovered is actually quite comparable to King Tut's tomb found in Egypt around the same time. Now, our first area in Mesopotamia, you can see I've circled Sumer. So it's ancient Sumer. Sumer is a kind of region that's made up of city-states. So it would be like if Houston was in charge of itself and Dallas was in charge of itself and Austin was, but we were all united, city-states that are independent but united together. The rulers in this culture are actually considered to be a representative of the gods. So not a god themselves, but someone who acts on behalf of the god and speaks for the god. They have some specific responsibilities. If you're a ruler and a priest in these cultures and these civilizations, you have canal construction. So we need water, right? We need to get water from the rivers to our cities. Crop collection, that's important because we need to feed the masses. And so you need to collect the crops and then you will need to distribute them to everyone. This agricultural development is so great, so vast in this area that we need specialization, which means that not everyone's growing the same thing. Not everyone is doing every step of the growing process. You dedicate people to do certain jobs. Someone is planting, someone is watering, someone is harvesting. You get really good at your specialized job, which makes a more productive growing process. Now, not only in growing are we getting specialization, but we have manufacturing. So making goods like pottery and textile, those types of things. Trade. We're going to talk about a lot of different civilizations in this area, a lot of different city-states just in Sumer, and you may be trading. So you're going to have people who are specialized in trade, administrative duties, and then, of course, writing, which means we are now out of prehistory and moving into history because history means that we have written documentation. And in fact, our oldest written documents are Sumerian records of commercial transactions and administrative acts, which sounds really, really exciting, I know. So if you'll look at your first photograph on slide 6 from ancient Sumer, this is a carving from about 3400 BCE. And this was used to take inventory of cattle because I don't know if any of you guys have been to a cattle farm, but when you have more than, you know, 40 cattle to keep up with, you need to keep a tally. So you know that you have this many on this day. And if you're missing some the next day, well, we need to go looking for cattle, or someone's been in your, on your land taking your cattle. So they have to keep inventory. Also for things like food and goods, when you start to have so much of something, right, you need to keep track of it. So these drawings are called pictographs. Pictographs means that you're taking something like a cow, I mean, for instance, and then you're making a picture that's really simplified to stand for that word. Now, in this case, you can see that I've given you like a code at the top, and you can tell that these images stand for letters. So this would have been a soft piece of clay that they would have been carved into with a sharp tool. The first language is cuneiform. You've probably heard of that. And it's read from top to bottom and right to left, so backwards from how we read. And our first real piece of literature is Epic of Gilgamesh. And you can click on that link if you want to watch a video about the Epic of Gilgamesh. But we're going to move on. So our first architectural feature that we're going to discuss in Sumeria is the White Temple at Uruk. So this is from 3200 BCE, and this was a religious shrine. So you can see that it's got corners and that they are aligned with the cardinal points, which would be north, south, east, and west. We think it was a dedicated temple to a sky god, which explains why it's elevated. The gods reside in the skies to the Sumerians, which we know is very common in most cultures to have gods in the sky. Now, the Sumerians are our first culture to build communal religious shrines on these high platforms that you see in this picture. So that means communal, a whole community coming together, not just a small altar in a house, but an actual public gathering area. Now, if you move to the next slide, you can see what's left of the White Temple at Uruk. Not much, basically just the platform that it would have sat on, and that has clearly eroded over the last 5,000 years. Now, if you move on to slide 9, you can see some examples of sculpture from the Sumerian culture. These are called the Eshnunna statuettes. They're about from 2700 BCE, and they were found in a sacred space. So probably like a smaller shrine, and they were dedicated to the goddess Inanna, who was their goddess of love and war. Now, she is the most important female deity, female god, in all the periods of Mesopotamian history. So across many, many years, she is still the most important. Now, these are about 30 inches tall, so not quite 3 feet tall, but they are worshipers who probably would have represented a Sumerian person. So you would leave these worshipers in this sacred space to let the gods know that you're still worshiping them. The word you need to know here is votive, and that just means created to connect with the gods. So it could be something that's almost 3 feet tall in a sacred space to a god, or something you carry with you to remind you and give you a feeling of connection to that god. That's a votive. So in the Sumerian city-states, there's a city-state named Ur, which would have been the home to the biblical Abraham. And in this area, we find a lot of dead. A lot of the dead were buried in underground chambers. So they're hidden away in underground chambers inside this cemetery area, which means we're able to find and recover these artifacts from 5,000, 4,000 years ago because they've been underground this entire time. So right here, we have what's called the Standard of Ur. So a standard is a box. As you can see, it's a uniquely shaped box, a quadrilateral, if you want to get technical with the geometry here. But it would have screwed into the top of a pole, and a military procession would have carried it at the beginning of their procession, almost like a flag. So this would have sat on top of a pole, and a person would have carried it. It's got lapis lazuli, which is a very rich blue gemstone you can see in the background. There's shell used for the figures, and then some red limestone, which you can see on the chariots. There's a war side, and there is a peace side. So you can imagine if you're marching towards war, you would probably have your war site open, facing who you approach. And then when you're returning from war, you would flip the standard so that you approach your city with the peace side visible. So if you move to the next side, you can see the war side. Now we know this is a war side because we have men dressed in military regalia, which is military clothing. We see swords, chariots, and at the very bottom register, which is another word you should know, we call these levels either bands or registers. So this has three registers. And at the very bottom, you can see that people are being trampled by horses actually on this one. So this is the war side. Now your next side is going to show you the peace side. Nobody's being trampled by horses. We have a lot of agriculture. There's production, domestication of animals. Women seem to be seated and sewing. Music is being played. It's peaceful. No trampling, no chariots, no military wares shown. So this is your standard of Ur. I do want to touch on our next slide, slide 13. It is a bullhead harp, which you can guess why it's called the bullhead harp, because it is a harp with a bullhead on it. A lot of this ancient stuff, guys, does not have a super creative name to it because it's basically just an identifying term, a bullhead harp. This was found in a tomb of a queen of Sumer. It was broken, but we've since restored it. Now, if you look at the head of the bull, you can see that it's gold, and that is actual pieces of gold that are hammered really thin and then attached to the sculpture. So that's called gold leaf. And then the beard on the bull is made out of that blue gemstone lapis lazuli. And you can see that there is a wooden box. That's the sound box, so where the sound would go in and reverberate out. And if you go to your next slide, you'll see a close-up of the image on the sound box. So this is pretty unique. It has four registers, so four levels, and each one shows us something different. So let's start at the top. At the top, we have what looks like we'll describe him as a heroic man because he looks strong, and he's embracing two man bulls, which we call a minotaur. On the register below that, we see that we have some more animal figures, and they are serving food and wine or some other kind of beverage. Do you notice that the feet of the first man on the top register are facing sideways, like a profile view, but the man's face is facing in front of you? You're getting a frontal view. This is called a composite view, and we're going to see this followed up in Egyptian culture. If you stood up right now and tried to stand with your feet sideways and your front, your torso facing frontally, it would be very difficult. But you can see that our artists in the 2600 BCE era are trying to show us three dimensions, but not quite there yet. If you keep going down to the third register, you're going to see a donkey playing a harp. And at the very bottom, we have a scorpion man. We don't have any writings on this. There is no documentation for what this was used for, but we can assume that these are some type of part of their religious belief system. That's what we can assume because it's on a musical box. It's got some kind of story behind it. We just don't know what the story is. So let's move on to our next culture, which are the Akkadians. So if you look on your map, Akkad is still in Mesopotamia, which is modern day Iraq. So we're still in that Fertile Crescent region between the Tigris and the Euphrates. Now, the Akkadians were the first Mesopotamian rulers to actually call themselves kings of the world, and they are not speaking on behalf of the gods anymore. They claim to be the gods. They are divine themselves. The earliest record name of an author is actually from Akkadian priestess named, I'm going to try my best on this one, Enhudwana. And she was a priestess of the god Nana. So it was a female author. I'm like butchering that one. Okay, so let's go ahead and move on to the next group of people. Our next culture are the Akkadians from Akkad, which is still in Mesopotamia in the Fertile Crescent region, right between our Tigris and our Euphrates rivers. Now the Akkadians are the first to actually come out and call themselves kings. They also are the first to assume divine attributes, which means they're not like the Sumerians who said they were speaking on behalf of the gods. They are claiming themselves to be divine. We also have our first author, our earliest recorded name of an author, named Eduad Inhudwana. That's a hard one. An Akkadian priestess of the god Nanna. So it's a female author. So we're dating back to 2300 BCE for this period. So remember I said that Sumer had a system of city-states. So they're linked, but they're their own independent city-states. In 2332 BCE, they actually come together under the domination of one ruler, Sargon of Akkad. So he, under the domination is the key word there, he kind of forces these city-states to unite under him near Babylon. So if you look on your map, you can see Akkad is circled, and then you'll see Babylon a little further south for it. We don't really know the exact location of Akkad. We just know it's in that general vicinity from our writings we have. They spoke Akkadian, which is a very similar language to Hebrew and Arabic. And under Sargon, this new leader, he institutes a concept of power where you are to be unswervingly loyal to the king rather than to the city-state. So yes, you're still part of a city-state, but your ultimate loyalty lies with that one king. Now, if you move to slide 17, you will see a bronze, or actually it's copper. It is a copper head. You'll notice it's missing a few features, but it is a head of an Akkadian ruler. Remember, this is an absolute monarchy, which means your king has ultimate power. And when your king has ultimate power, not everyone is going to agree with what the king does or love the king. And so you can see here that we've got some eyes missing, which are evident of deliberate mutilation. Someone probably after the king's death went through and took out his eyes, gouged out his eyes. His beard has also been broken and his ears have been sliced off. Now, this is a very naturalistic or similar to nature is what that means, portrait of a king. So if you go back to our sound box where we have our heroic man holding the two minotaurs, not super naturalistic, not really what we look like, our faces look like naturally. This is much closer. The lips, the ears, if they were there, would probably also, but the nose, they look realistic. Now it is abstract because if you look at the beard, nobody's beard in real life is curled like that. This is called stylized, which we talked about in our very first podcast about style and how that's unique to a culture. And this is distinct for the Akkadians, these twisted curling beards. That's their style. So this is a stylized detail. This is the head of an Akkadian ruler. So this is all we have left. I don't know if it was part of a larger body, but this is what we have found. If you look at the bottom of the picture, you'll see the 1-inch mark. So you can kind of tell how big it is. I'm probably about a foot for this head. Now, if you move to the next slide, this is called the Naram-Sin Stele. A stele is just a carved piece of stone. Remember, when you're only carving into something, it's a relief carving. So this is a relief sculpture or relief carving. You can call it either. This is a victory stele. So it means that Naram-Sin, this ruler, has, you know, won a battle. And it actually shows that the defeat of the Lullabi, which were a group of people living in the Iranian mountains at the time. So you can see that we've got a few different registers here, but we're moving in an angle because it's telling us a story. It's a narrative. So you start at the bottom and you work your way up, but it's really showing you the progression of a story, which this is the first time we see that in art history. So this is a very important piece of art. So the story is this triumphant battle. Now, if you look at the stele, you're going to notice that one person is much larger than the others. And you can probably take a wild guess at who that person is. The most important person would be Naram-Sin. And this is called hierarchical scale. Hierarchical scale is the way of making the most important person the biggest person, so they stand out above everyone else. You want to make sure whenever you show this that everyone can identify who Naram-Sin is, and he is, of course, the largest person. In fact, he dwarfs. He is over twice the size of most of his soldiers and of the people he is defeating. Now, if you jump down to slide 19, you will see we are moving into Neo-Sumerian art. So it's a little bit the New Sumerians. So we're a little bit further in, about 1,000 years after our first Sumerian stuff. So we're still in that area of Sumer. This is called a ziggurat at Ur. And ziggurats are platforms. So when you look at this, you see a stairway. It walks up. This thing is massive. And at the top of this would have been a temple. But the ziggurat itself is just the platform. So they would construct these huge, massive platforms, and then a temple would be placed on top to one of their gods. All right, so on slide 20, we're moving into Babylonian art. So same area, but now we're in Babylon, that kind of city-state area. This is a statue in the round, which means you can walk all the way around it. It's not a relief statue or a relief sculpture. This is of Gudea, and his name is Gudea of Lagash, and he reigned about 2100 in Babylon. And he put up many, many temples and placed portraits of himself all over the place. We have over 24 portraits of him that survived from 4,000 years ago. So you know that he was very careful about placing his sculptures in many places so he would be seen. These would have been votive offerings to the gods. So remember, votive means connecting you to the gods. So he would place these in probably temples as a representation of him and his relationship to the gods. It's made out of diorite, which is a really strong, almost like granite material. But he is missing his head. And if we know anything about, or we remember anything I just told you about the Akkadian ruler, if you're missing something, there are two possibilities. It was an accident or it was on purpose. So to take off the head clean like that, it could go either ways, but I'm going to say it was probably on purpose. So our last carving, kind of work. Oh, I lied. We have one more after this. That's okay. So this is still Babylon. This is the Stele of Law Codes. This is something you are probably pretty familiar with if you've heard of Hammurabi and his Law Codes. He is Babylon's greatest king. He reigns for about 40 years and establishes this very specific code of laws for the empire that he rules. If you look at the top, and you can skip to the next slide to see this too, we see what's called foreshortening, which means that you draw something a little bit shorter to make it look like it's further back. So if you look at the arms on the figures, you can see that they're manipulating the size of the arms just to make them look like they're placed back. Specifically on the seated figure, you can see that. Now, we definitely have hierarchical scale again. So the largest person is the most important. So on your right, you have a god, and he is handing to Hammurabi basically this divine right. So yes, they look like they're the same size, but we have to take into account that the god is seated, which means ultimately the most important person and the largest person is this god who is seated in front of Hammurabi. Now on slide 23, I give you a few samples of some of the law codes from Hammurabi, so you can feel free to read through those. But we're going to jump to slide 24, which is Assyrians, which are in Assyria. And Neo-Babylonian art. So the Assyrians actually had an empire you can see here that went from the Persian Gulf on the side of the Arabian Peninsula all the way around into Egypt. It was a very wide-ranging empire. And they named themselves after the god Ashur. So they're taking on that role, that name from this god. If you look on slide 25, this is called the Lamassu. And this is an Assyrian relief sculpture because it is carved into a wall. But it's very three-dimensional. It projects very, very far from the wall. We call that a high relief. It is a man-headed winged bull. So get all those elements in there. And it's meant to ward off the king's enemies. So these would have been placed at a gate, and the ruler would have had these placed at the gate to kind of ward off enemies, be they supernatural or physical enemies. It's about 14 feet tall, and it has 5 legs, which in this image you can only see 4. But if you were to stand in front of the Lamassu, you would also see another leg in the front, because these artists haven't quite figured out how to show an animal walking. And so they went ahead and made sure you could see an extra leg from the front. So no matter where you're looking at it, it looks correct. And it's partially in the round because you can walk almost all the way around it. All right. And then our last work from Mesopotamia in Persia is this Neo-Babylonian gate, which is called the Ishtar Gate. It is beautifully carved with lapis lazuli, that same blue gemstone. And if you look really closely, you can see the guardrails and how small the guardrails are, which are probably about 4 feet tall in comparison to the rest of the gate. And you can see in the middle, this is in a museum now that's been rebuilt in this museum. You can see the walkway and how small it is compared to the actual gate. Babylon was thought to be home to 2 of the 7 wonders of the ancient world. So it was a very prolific civilization. And the Ishtar Gate kind of gives you an idea of that magnificence of this civilization, of this culture. This was built for Nebuchadnezzar II, and it would have been the entrance to Babylon. Okay, so you can follow up with chapter 2 to get some more content, and then we will pick up on chapter 3 next time. Thank you.